be wise. Shamshi is twice as canny as Artan and Lysis. If those two found the wizard boy and chased him, then Sham allowed it, or some other power took a hand. Something rings wrong about the trainee's encounter with Shamshi, and Nico feels it. If Artan and Lysis had been mounted, surely they could have run down Shamshi on the hard-packed sand. Neither boy could explain why they'd hunted on foot when Lysis was lame. "It seemed the right thing to do," Lysis had said, "with my leg wound and all. But we hit him. I know we hit him with the poison dart. Exactly the way you showed us, Stealth." Young Artan had said nothing, simply looked at Nico like a rabbit surprised on a country road. "Then we ought to find a body unless the riptide took it out to sea," Nico mused. But there was no body, not even a finger or a piece of cloth. "Lysis, tell your father he can build an altar to Harmony, next to Enlil's on the hill, just where he wants it. Only not so large that the war god will be jealous." He'd meant it, humorously. Neither boy chuckled, just looked at him with big round eyes. Gian caught Nico at the barracks in the open before the noon meal. "Stealth!" She crushed him close and then pushed him back, hands gripping his shoulders. "The Riddler says he needs no help, that you didn't call for me. Why is that?" He rubbed the back of his neck and tried to remember, watching the play of light in the eyes and upon the skin of the Froth Daughter, and on her scale armor, finer than mortal hands could fashion. "Jehan, I was at wit's end. Tempest was blind. His chest wound wasn't healing. I walked into the water off Lemuria and asked for help helping him. That's all." "Harumph. And what did you think would happen next? I've seen that wound. It's closed." She was exquisite, more than human and twice as fierce as any man. "I assumed you had by now." The Riddler and Jihan's exploits in love and war were legend among the stepsons and now throughout the greater sacred band. "Jian." He must be careful. The Riddler was the proudest man Nico had ever met. "Is he failing? Fading? Or is he truly well again?" Jian cocked that head and her pinwheel eyes spun, sparking fire. She said, "I'd forgotten how you love him. He's well enough, better than any mortal could think to be, and always will be." She folded shapely arms, so muscled she could lift him off the ground. "You pretend to balance, but you love him too much for that. Look to yourself, young fighter." She tapped her booted foot. "It's been a long time since anyone has called me that." He smiled a slow smile at her, which always got him far with women. "There was a girl out at the feast. I lost track of her." "Better than losing track of yourself," Jehan said and flounced away, scale armor shining on that high rump in the sun. "And stay away from Ascalon," she called back over her shoulder. "The Riddler is not pleased with you for bringing the Dream Lord down upon us." He knew that. He got his dream-forged panoply and their second-best troce horse and a long-handled rake. He was going back out to the seashore. But Tempest caught him before he was out the gate. There was hell in his commander's eyes. "Off the horse." He slid off, butt to horse, and stood in front of everyone. Would the commander chastise him? The Riddler looked him up and down and up again and said in a voice like whispering gravel, Where are you going without telling me? I have Randall and Ishard still hunting Shamshi. Not good here, where sorcery's outlawed and necromance don't exist. And Critty is trying to keep track of them while keeping track of everything else. Nico stood very still, just waiting, meeting the Riddler's savage glare, holding the rake in one hand and the Trosse's reins in the other. I haven't seen Randall yet. He'll find me when he needs to. And will the rest of us? Torch is furious about exposing Kurus to Ascalon. Is Kurus a slave to this priest? Have we sold him to the palace? Last time I looked, he was a stepson, ours to deploy. That tight-lipped mouth told him the trap was sprung. Then take Kurus with you until all his questions are answered and he remembers he's a trainee. Make him hold your rake. I'm going down to I know where you're going and what you're trying to do. A witness would be helpful if you get yourself killed or mortally wounded out on the sand spit, to come back and tell me where to look for a body. If we can't find Shamshi's, we can at least find yours. And call in no more reinforcements of the non-human sort. I've enough to do without more help. The Riddler dismissed him with a wave of hand. Nico mounted up, the back of his neck hot. At least it had been quiet. But then it wasn't.
Kurus, here!
Bellowed the Riddler. Kurus must have been waiting on the big blue roan, for the youth trotted right up, pale and bleary-eyed. Nico reined the Trosse around and didn't look back to see if Kurus followed until the gates had closed behind them. Not till they were out at the spit again, deep in the dunes, did Nico say a word to Kurus. He was too busy preparing himself as best he could.
You'll keep watch, Kurus,
Nico told the storm god's son. The Riddler had been right. Of course, as he always was. If Nico must attempt this thing, someone should be with him. Be his sentry, his guardian at the gate. He stopped his horse, where the sand was flat, between two dunes. Was this where he'd come with the dancing girl? Perhaps, but the wind had scoured the sand clear of tracks and marks of human passage overnight. The clean-up crew was far off, on the other side of the lighthouse. The sea smoothed the shore, slathering bubbly foam inland and leaving shining wet sand behind. Kurus knew enough to be quiet and simply hold horses while Nico chose his spot and began raking a pattern in the sand. The sun was high before he finished. He'd made a perfect circle, mimicked by gulls overhead and one lone osprey, gliding, curious, above his design. Still, Nico was not calm, although he knew what to do and how to do it.
Kurus, take those horses over the next dune and wait there.
The trainee was too full of when and if and might have been and might be to look for Shamshi, fanning his own young senses out wide, trying to help. But that wasn't the kind of help Nico needed. Nico fell silent, so Kurus did too. Kurus, bursting with questions, voiced none, and did as he was told. Then Nico was free to step into the middle of his circle with its spiral to the center, and sit down there. He wore his dream-forged armor. He had his sword belt girded on.
If Ascalon was right and this fight could be won by force of arms, he was ready. He breathed deeply, until his breathing changed and welled up from his diaphragm, a different rhythm. He composed his mind and let his body's tension drift away. Overhead, seagulls cried like babies. The osprey's shadow circled round and round across the spot he was watching where tiny, pale sand crabs burrowed industriously among the grains of sand. Some errant breeze stroked his cheek. The rustle of the waves grew louder, roaring, then crashed against the beach. That primal cadence caught his soul finally, and he was floating, and then riding on those waves and propelled toward shore. Almost there. Almost there. Nico is almost home, where his soul can be refreshed, where his meadow, star-shaped and evergreen, meets the sea with its stream and its blue sky like eternity. This is where he wants to be, where he wants to meet Sham, if there must be a fight. Let this battle take place here, in his rest place, where time doesn't matter and age is not an issue. Where any fight is fair, but no fight is fairest. Where his heart always longs to be, in the ankle-deep grass where wild flowers grow and a fragrant breeze touches his skin. Without warning, he is snatched away, flung into another place. In this other place, nothing exists but shrieking and bleeding and dark death hurtling through the skies. Arrows arcing, long spears thunking into flesh, men staggering backward, impaled, screaming. Arrows whiz by his head, long spears piercing, glittering in the sunlight. Men and horses bellow, maneuvers carefully drilled, impossible to complete. Waves of death breaking on the Chironian plain. So many falling, piled one upon the other. Now Shamshi comes striding. Not a youth, but a force as old as death. Familiar with wearing boys' faces and men's faces and the faces of all the gods. Armed and armored, crest on a blood-red helmet, bobbling, this thing wants battle. Long spears thunk by him, just softening him up. Now it has a sword, and has minions behind it. First a unit, then a cohort, then a phalanx. Nico can die, be spitted here, can bleed out his life here as easily as he could in his own rest place or on Sanctuary's dunes. This young adept has pulled him from one reality to another. Into Shamshi's chosen battle space where severed heads roll. Bloated tongues sticking out through purple lips. Sightless eyes stare him down, their eye whites greenish, their skin mottled blue with death. Shamshi and Nico will both have to step over bodies for this contest to be joined. Nico uses his shield to call the battle to order, pounding twice on it with the flat of his blade. It's the shield that Ascalon made him. Ready, Sham? New drill today. This Shamshi wants to fight hand to hand. But the boy, or the image of the boy, doesn't answer. That's fine.
Nico has taught Sham to stay focused, keep quiet, never to betray your intention with your eyes, your body, or your mouth. And it's difficult to keep your mind and your body focused in two places at once. A man can lose it all here, trying to attempt too much before mastering the lessons that can keep you alive. But there are other lessons, more advanced. Come on then, boy. Bring me what you've got, he calls, not knowing if he's saying it here or there, or in both places simultaneously. Gladly for what you did to me, spits a voice from inside that bronze helmet. Traitor! So Sham can speak. Here. Impressive. Not encouraging. Revenge is never the best driver for a battle, but a common one. Nico knows that Sham may have made an error choosing this kind of combat. For a moment, Nico wishes with all his heart that Sham had come to him on Sanctuary's sandy spit, in the clean sunlight. There was nothing more he'd like to do today than hack some problem limb from limb, disembowel something unequivocally. But for real. In practice, not for practice. Careful, you could die here. He had nearly died once before fighting in a place like this, and that place had been nowhere near as awful as this one. Had Shamshi been coming here time and time again, eviscerating corpses, practice foes again and again? Not good. Bowstrings hum, arrows whisper through the bleak light in this dreadful place where the stench of death is all around, though nothing truly lives here, or ever has lived here. The thing that is Sham leaps over two corpses to get to him and comes down fighting. No quarter asked or given. Grunts and thumps and parries and the screech of iron on bronze. Swords and shields are all that matter now. Archers, if ever they were there, have fled or disappeared. Hoplites, too. Javelins are no part of this fight. This youth wants to feel muscle against muscle, pulse against pulse. But battle here is as real as battle can be, and Sham's foot slips on gore. Lunge, slash, lunge, parry, riposte, parry, slash, thrust, parry, riposte, and parry again. Disengage and try to dislodge the other man's grip on his weapon. Smash him in the helmet with your shield. Parry and thrust. Now push. Knee against overbalanced weight, a screech of short sword's edge on cuirass, and Nico has, for 1 second, a clear strike at an exposed pale throat. And doesn't take it. Instead, he kicks a grieved leg out from under his adversary as Sham grabs for purchase and catches his shield arm. They both go down together in the gory mud. His sword hand is caught under Sham's shoulder momentarily. Then he grabs the youth like a lover and rolls them both over, his shield and sword behind Sham's back, are nearly useless for an instant as he does. Between them are just wordless grunts as two men roll in the mud and blood. Nico lands on his back. Sham's legs are trying to get around him, scissor him, roll him once more. Nico gets a knee between Sham's and jams it upward, using his shield under Sham's chin to force the other's head back and back. a second chance. There's no reasoning with this boy. His trainee that he has perhaps trained too well, and those before him on Bandera may have trained too well. They slip and slide and roll amid the gore, coming to rest with Nico on top of Shamshi. This time, Nico takes his opportunity, slamming with the point of his short sword deep into Sham's neck with the stroke that could be mortal, would be, should be if what happens here today is reflected on the earthly plane. And getting stabbed himself in return, up under his cuirass, a deadly strike, if executed flawlessly, into vital organs. But today not perfect enough. His cuirass catches the guard on Sham's sword, stopping the thrust short. As Shamshi's corpse-to-be begins shuddering and coughing under him, Nico says, "This is taking far too long. I don't suppose you'd like to talk about it. The Dream Lord thinks we should." If this battle is one of wills, not flesh, and the combat here symbolic, there is still time to compromise. It's what they should do, what Bandaran practice requires, what Nico feels he must offer to a fellow initiate, no matter how lethal a turn their combat takes. Then Sham's shield smashes into Nico's helmet, and consciousness explodes into colors. Along with everything Nico can remember, that battle plane dissolves. Now Nico sees sand, tastes it in his mouth, has a face full of it, and a headache that makes his eyes tear. He half expects to be bleeding from his kidneys, from his bladder, or his right buttocks, or his hip. But he isn't. Yet. Pain rushes over him in waves. Sweat covers his face, running in rivulets into his eyes, down his cheeks to his chin, and dripping from his jaw. Pain pounds harder at him, crashing in on his consciousness like surf swamps a jetty. Perspiration breaks out all over him from the pain in his back, down his hip and his flank. He's sweating behind his knees in the creases of his elbows. The cold sweat is running down his breastbone. So much pain is never good. He starts to shiver. The edges of his vision go black. Sham was vicious, but inexperienced. Nico should have ended it at the first opportunity. Could have. Would have if the youth had been a man or the battle joined on Sanctuary's sand. But he's in too much pain to think clearly. He can feel the damage now. Far too real for the wages of symbolic combat. Every chunk of ripped flesh, every bit of skin that's split asunder, flares agonizingly. He's wounded, worse than he'd first thought, or expected. His injury shouldn't be this bad. Shamshi shouldn't be this strong. He doesn't understand it. Now Nico bleeds. He's bleeding down the leg from some thrust that struck home and sliced him all the way from there to here. He doesn't see the blood until he staggers to his feet. It's dark blood, venal, not bright red. It's dripping, not spurting out of him, that's good. However much these wounds hurt, they're survivable if he doesn't lose too much blood. He stands with legs widespread, weaving just a little on his feet. He'd underestimated Shamshi. Underestimating an enemy is an error most fighters don't have a chance to make twice.
He'd meant to kill the representation of Sham quickly on that simulacrum of a battle plane as an example of what could happen in Sanctuary if Shamshi didn't quit and run. Or kill him altogether, unequivocally, as a final result, if the young fighter was talented enough to make what happened there and here one and the same. He had not meant to give an exhibition of how not to kill someone you're trying to reason with. He was ashamed of his indecision. If it happened again, it could kill him, even there. If it happened here, he'd deserve to die.
Chorus, you can bring the horses now.
Chorus saw the blood and his eyes widened.
Sir, I mean...
Bandage. I must have rolled on my sword when I dozed in the sand just then. It's been a long night. The boy brought the wadding and they got the sand out of the wounds, stanched the blood enough for him to ride. It's not going to be easy getting on that horse. He doesn't want Chorus to see how hard it is to stand on his right leg and then swing it over that horse's back in order to mount. He needed to stop getting damaged where a man sat a horse. When they both were mounted, Chorus said,
"Did you kill?"
The sand is bright around him, but his vision is full of clouds.
"Maybe. Probably not. But if not, I bet Sham's thinking hard about what's worth what."
So is he. End of chapter 24. Chapter 25. Weapon of the God. First comes the wolf's call, one of the Wizard Wall veterans giving the old Nisi signal for incoming wounded from atop the barracks wall. To fix disorder in his house, Enlil always reaches for Tempus. He's out of the barracks like the wrath of gods, which he sometimes is, and is today. Bareback on the trace, barreling at a dead run toward the two approaching horsemen, he's through the opening gates before the others even gather in the courtyard. Now the ululation is picked up by the stepsons inside the compound. Gian comes racing on foot, frowning. Stratton and Crit, bawling orders, are marshalling the sacred band. Someone's coming in, badly hurt. The gates draw back. Some bring litters on the run to others scrambling for horses, medicine, and bandage. Randall stumbles down the stairs. But there's plenty of time. With the gates open wide, everybody waits there. There's too much time. The horsemen are coming very slowly. The commanders mount, reaching the incoming horses, wheels, and comes alongside. Three abreast across the dirt track they ride on, just single footing. Two gray trace horses and a blue roan ambling down the road. Jihan looks at Randall and Stratton, at Critias, and heads shake. There's more than time enough to get prepared. Crit and Strat ready their mounts and weapons, but not hurriedly. The Riddler is out there and signals them to stay where they are. A young wolf's yip. Once, twice, it echoes, forlorn. So it's not that kind of fight today. No one doubts what it means. Three horses coming so painstakingly, so slowly toward the barracks. Tempest should have known. Whenever Ascalon appears, the wager is always more than you can afford to lose. He paces the two incoming riders.
He knows what he sees. Nico, with Kouris close beside him and blood dripping down his side, his leg, off his foot. A blood trail of dashes and dots, stretching out far behind them on the ground. Nico is swaying in his saddle, shocky, helmet by his knee, shield dented. His skin is pallid and translucent. Veins stand out sharp and clear. Nico has the grab strap on his saddle in his right hand, reins wrapped around his left. His head is down, his lips pale. Tempus's Trose strikes out with a forefoot at the smell of blood and screams a belly-shaking protest. Nico's Gray answers, sidestepping, nearly unseating his rider.
"What happened, Nico?"
Tempus says above the hoofbeats and the squeak of leather, snort and blow of horses.
"Nico!"
Stealth doesn't respond, then knits his brow and turns his head, so slowly.
"Nothing much. Inconclusive."
He rocks too much in that saddle, trying to keep the weight off his bloody right side. Tempus can't see where the blood is coming from. There's too much of it, soaking the blanket, meandering in rivulets. He reaches down and snatches Nico's right rein, and gets no argument.
"Kouris, where were you?"
Vyshenka's son is on Nico's left side, face dirty, eyes wide.
"Where he told me to be, holding the horses over the dune."
Nearly in tears, the young fighter looks helplessly from one man to the other. He scrubs his face with a grimy hand.
"It's a long ride home. It didn't seem so bad when we started."
Tempus sidles his horse close enough to grab the bleeding stepson if Stealth starts to slide off his horse. Blood drips down Nico's leg, so slowly, and dribbles down, more slowly yet, onto the sand. Careful strides take forever to cover any ground. His stepson sways too much one way, too much the other. Right arm braced, side to side, forward and back, head nodding down, snapping upright. They've been through this too many times before. The worst is going so slowly, carefully, with so much at stake. But Tempus knows his partner. If Nico is able, he'll ride into those barracks under his own power.
"We could have done without the armor this whole long ride back from the lighthouse spit. We could have done without this wizard spawn Shamshi in the first place."
When they've nearly reached the gate, the sacred band starts calling out. Tempus lifts one hand and drops it. "Stay back." Nico raises his head and stares, then catches Tempus, eye to eye. Nico has a feral look, desperate and demanding, like a panther in a trap.
"I got on this horse by myself. I'll get off it by myself."
That voice is barely audible, but Tempus knows what Nico is going to say. Knows what's going to pass those lips.
"Don't you let Gian get me down or put her hands on me where the men can see. Or try to heal me. Or let any of them. Damn, not again."
He can see the Froth Daughter pacing at the gates, hands on her hips.
"I'll do it," Tempest says. No argument possible on either side.
You dismount, and I'll help you the rest of the way. He never should have let Nico go out there with only a trainee, Banderin or not. Never should have let Nico take Shamshi to Bandera to begin with. My quarters, just me, you, Strat, and Crit. Nico nods his head very slightly, furrows deep on his forehead as if he's struggling to remember something. Chorus is looking back and forth between them.
Chorus, right ahead. Tell Crit we don't need a litter, just him and Strat. Clear everyone else out of the yard.
Chorus rides off, first slowly, cautiously, trotting until he's far enough away, and then galloping.
Nico?
We won this round, if it matters. Couldn't bring myself to kill him there, the fighter mumbles. Took a while. Wound's not really that bad.
And almost falls off the horse's near side before Tempest grabs his arm.
Now, God, what have you to say? One more sword, Enlil. One more body spilling blood. Does it matter in thine awful sight? This time, and from now on, no mercy for these enemies. And Enlil swears, on this and every day hereafter, loud as thunder in his head so that his ears pound with it. The sky above takes up that thunder and shakes the ground.
Tempest agrees with the god's anger, expressed by the tremor and distant lightning coming close. Today he wants thunder, lightning, blinding rain to wash everything and everybody clean. Not even in Chironea did the god have anything to say. This one fighter, this weapon of the god, has shaken Enlil awake, got the storm god's holy attention. But is it worth the cost? Ever? The day has no shadows left by the time Tempest gets Nico inside the barracks gates. Everyone stands well back. Men will watch whatever they're told not to. Tempest slides off his trouse and comes around to help. Stratton takes Tempest's horse. Crit takes Nico's by the bit. Randall peeks out from behind a half-closed stall door, his eyes glittering with tears. Jihan is beside him, glaring. No one says a word as Tempest waits by the Grey's left side.
Nico, drop your shield.
Nico squints down as if at a 100-mile drop over the gray horse's left shoulder. Shaking the shield from his arm, he lets it fall. Tempest catches it and hands it to Strat. Nico sighs and nods his head just once. Then he swings his right leg over, gasps for breath. Tempest already knows what's coming. Nico lets himself down too fast, too hard, or loses his grip. One grunt and his right leg hits the ground. It doesn't hold him. Tempest hadn't thought it would. He's ready. For once, the god's speed means something. He gets his shoulder under Nico's right arm and hoists him. They walk that way together into Tempest's quarters, Nico's feet barely dragging the ground.
Tempest has seen the wound. He knows what to do now. So does Critias. So does Stratton. They've been here before. With Enlil's help, they'll be here again. And the god is being kind today. As soon as they get Nico on that bed, he passes out. The sky is pregnant with rain, promising a torrent, nothing new for storm-wracked sanctuary. Just a portent of Enlil's divine attention. Tempest wants the rain today. Usually wants it, except when it's flooding a battle plain, when mud is all around, chariots sinking in and horses slipping. Long spears thunking into flesh. Tempest is known by many epithets collected over countless wars. The Riddler, the Obscure, the Sleepless One, favorite of the Storm God, the Black, and more. Today, he is Tempest the Black. He is furious and focused. He needs to get Nico some more help. He just doesn't know what kind yet. The wounds to Stealth's body should heal. Can heal. As to Nico's deeper wounds, who can say? And Nico asks only for some girl he met on the lighthouse spit. Maybe it's just delirium. Men, wounded as grievously as Nico, often do and say strange things when dream and waking mix with pain. Those wounds shouldn't have been there. Shamshi shouldn't be this strong. Something happened on the battle plain in Kyrenia that no one understands. And Nico is paying the price again. Gods colliding, ethos and mythos trying to combine. The sacred band caught up in a whirlwind not of any god's devising. He and Nico had wanted to save 23 pairs of fated Theban fighters. Now everything feels fated, and fighting overruns its boundaries of time and place and plane. Nico lies bloody and wounded from a struggle in a battle space that exists only in the minds of those who fight there. Ascalon from a plain away, a place that exists only sometimes, shows up unbidden. His manifestations always cost more than anyone can afford. And Enlil, close and hot-blooded now, roused by so much ravaging of body and soul, is impatient, growling wordlessly in his ears, ready for revenge, looking for culprits to slay. Enlil is proprietary these days, with foreign gods running loose, and wants it made precisely clear who belongs to whom and whose loyalty lies where. Battle lines being drawn. Theomachy. Battle among gods or against gods. Tempest has seen it, time after time. Been on both sides of it, time after time. He heads toward processional way and the palace, and the meddlesome priest who has summoned him to talk about Chorus. Priest, we got your message. You want to talk about Chorus? Tempest tries not to snarl, and partially succeeds. Yes, Tempest, I want to talk about Giscarus, says Torchholder, smooth as silk. Let's talk. What about Chorus? There's a stone bench in the courtyard. They stand there, in the murky half-light of a sullen afternoon, the bench between them. Over watered fruit trees rot in pots lined up like sentries along the walls. Tempest finds that fitting. The priest is dressed in brown, looking monkish and credible for a man on the wrong side of everything Tempest believes in.
"Commander, we can't have you putting Giscaris in danger."
"You can't? He's a stepson. What do you think stepsons do? Sing hymns?" Tempest puts one foot on the stone bench and one elbow on his knee.
"Let me clarify. We don't want Giscaris exposed to pernicious influences like Ascalon of Meridian," says Torcholder.
"Kurus belongs to the sacred band, not to you," Tempest replies. Kurus was the answer to the priest's prayers, but Tempest meant to use the boy for his own purposes, not let Torchholder abuse him. "Kurus is a stepson, not a pawn in the games of the gods or their stewards." Kurus was born to a berserker's life of sack and pillage in Vashanka's name. Only his training in Bandera and the stepsons offered some faint hope that he'd outwit his destiny.
"Tempest, Giscaris belongs to Vashanka, not to you or your precious band or your god Enlil. And especially not to the Dream Lord."
The priest's doughy face screwed up, then smoothed.
"What were you thinking, exposing that boy to the regent of the Seventh Sphere? You were Vashanka's instrument during Giscaris' begetting. Ought to know better than to tempt the Dream Lord with a godson like Giscaris? Don't we have enough problems without the Lord of Dream and Shadow confusing your fighters and my congregation?"
"Whenever you think you can order Ascalon around, I'll hold your mantle and cheer you while you try it."
"Whenever Ascalon appears, bad things happen, but the Dream Lord can't be controlled. You should know that by now, fool."
"And you didn't have a congregation, or much of one, until Kurus came along. Perhaps you still don't. You've had a drought in your believers' hearts and in your treasury and in your fields. Now you've had some small relief, but it'll take more than a little thunder and lightning to keep your coffers full. And what happens when the rain won't stop and flood and famine come?"
"Giscaris will be Vashanka's avatar and the resurrection of all our hopes. You know that boy won't be able to resist it," Torchholder insists, approaching the bench.
Tempest warns him one more time to tread carefully. "You think Kurus can't resist? Care to bet your palace on it?" But Torch doesn't want to bet. Tempest wishes Torchholder were the right enemy at this most wrong of times. Torch doesn't really want to fight. He simply wants access to Giscaris. He won't try to take him by scheme or force. This arrangement between the palace and the sacred band is too useful to them both. This audience is over. The priest has had his say. So Tempest asks casually, "Speaking of the fate, you chose all the dancers.
We want to find one of your dancing girls again. Do you have a list?
We must somewhere, and I think your cadre has one as well. I'll try to turn up a guest list. It will take some time. I'll walk you out.
Thus, having given all the warning he must for one day and gotten no information he can use, Tempest the Black goes on his way with thunder, lightning, and the promise of rain at his back, whipping like a cloak. He rides south on processional, looking further for a worthy foe, hoping he'll find Shamshi, or Shamshi will find him, down on Wide Way, past the docks. Here a warehouse that made naphtha incendiaries once stood and now does not, where Stealth's first partner was killed in an explosion long ago, when Ascalon's wizard weather roamed the streets. No sorcery hereabouts, nothing to worry about. Just a few hundred ghosts in various degrees of uneasy rest, in a thieves' warren struggling to become a reputable city-state. He checked in at his guard stations at Critias's hidey-hole in the maze. The guard was restless, up in his eyes, looking everywhere with unmitigated suspicion. He trotted the Tros through more memories than he'd thought he had here, grateful to be alone and riding, waiting for thunder to clap and lightning to split the belly of the rain clouds overhead, waiting for Shamshi, if he was abroad, to make a try at him. Please, oh please. He rode the day into night, he and his good Tros horse that Abarsus had brought to him here, when the ghost was still a man. Nothing jumped out to challenge them, no obliging street fighter or silent stalker emerged from cover. So he doubled back as torches were being lit on narrow streets, thinking to go over to the whorehold and ask in the Red Lantern's district about Nico's dancing girl from the Fate. Every time Nico is coherent in his sickbed, he asks for her. It seems a modest comfort, one that Tempest should provide. Quiet streets in Sanctuary are like two-headed calves or harlots turned to goddesses. Unnatural, out of balance, traps for men and gods alike. Wherever he went, he could find no sign of something wrong enough to put to rights, except in his heart, wounded once by spear and now again when his right-side partner went out without him and got hurt. His miscalculation. In these dank and ominous days filled with Thebans and skies that wouldn't rain but wouldn't clear. He was nearing Triumph Gate when he saw two men on a corner talking to a mounted Sacred Band pair. He stopped his horse, observing, till his stepsons trotted off. Then he kneed his Tros, a horse walking forward, nothing intimidating, a fighter with both hands in sight.
"Akeem," he said, "is that you?"
The elder of the two men there was as old as the hills of Azahar, and as scraggly, a storyteller, and once a confidant of the palace, an information monger.
"Tavis,"
said the roomy-eyed man through a mouth with a half-dozen teeth,
"you're really here?"
"No, old one, it's your imagination.
Anything I should know tonight?
Next to the storyteller, a man a fraction of his age was trying to melt back into shadow. An Ilsig with a flat, dark face. One he might have recognized if the torches hadn't been so sparse hereabouts.
"There's a change in the weather," the storyteller said. "But you know that. The stepsons and their friends have brought more trouble to town than anyone bargained for. Gods and fates and wild boys run amok in the streets."
Hakim raised his face, and it was 1,000 years old.
"But you know that too, don't you?"
"Tell me something I don't know. Something worth a coin or two, old friend, so you'll have a better bed tonight."
"There's a goddess moving in, hereabouts. A real one. And she's making converts here and there. And some of those are in your boys' beds, so beware."
"Is that all?"
The Tros stamped, blowing restlessly through its nostrils. Tempest was trying to place the younger man, half in shadows, who didn't quite dare to run.
"Not all. But sometimes a fellow doesn't want to tell the Riddler what the Riddler doesn't want to hear."
"Try me, uncle."
Hakim sighed, a phlegmy sound.
"I just told your men, so this tale's free. There's a youth living low in Downwind with too much money and too little to do, who's always where the action is. There were a few arrows loosed in shambles around sunset, aimed at your stepsons, which hit nothing. But your stepsons don't know where to look."
The old man grimaced at Tempest appraisingly. He tossed Hakim a copper coin. Now he thought he knew who the younger Ilsig was.
"But you told them where to look?"
"Of course. We always aim to be of service to the palace."
"Who's your Wriggly friend?"
"You know Zip, or your men do. Used to be the Revolution, when we had one. He made the naps the fireballs for your party on the spit."
As in former times, there was nothing worth knowing here that Hakim didn't know. The man in the shadows, taut and spare, raised a hand but came no closer. A voice he recalled vaguely said,
"I'm respectable now. A businessman. Doing nothing to interest you or yours besides selling the occasional legal fireworks."
Tempest urged his horse up on the shoulder of the street, off the cobbles.
"You know Downwind, Zip. Let's go hunting."
So he spent the night hunting shooters with Zip, turned up nothing, and didn't get back to the Street of Red Lanterns until the lightning finally ripped the clouds apart, just before dawn, and the rain came pouring down. Sham's fever was spiking again. He'd gone out to shoot stepsons with his crossbow, but he was too sick to hit anyone. Too dangerous out there for someone unfit to fight, with the Riddler's whole band swarming, chasing him. He'd already died once, or nearly so, fighting Nico in his rest place, and been resurrected by some pale and awful hand. His throat was pierced, his larynx stabbed. He'd been choking in his own blood, gasping,
dying. Wrestling with stealth called Nicodemus a better fighter than he'd ever met before.